Trade Bytes. The podcast about trade policy.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Trade Bytes, the podcast series by the Centre for Inclusive Trade Policy, and hosted by me, Chris Horseman, Deputy Editor of the Trade Policy News Service, Borderlex. Trade Bytes is the podcast series that gets forensic as it sifts the evidence at that crime scene that is UK trade policy. And in this episode, we're focusing on imports into the UK, and more specifically, the new border control system, which is being phased in by the government. Back in 2016, when all the talk was about taking back control, you'd have got long odds on the UK basically operating an open door to imports from the EU for more than 3 years after Britain left the single market. But that is indeed what happened. Five times the government announced the introduction of border controls on imports from the EU, and five times they were postponed for various operational and logistical reasons. But now, we're told, it's finally happening. So how will the new Border Target Operating Model, or BTOM, actually work? Is the new regime of border checks on higher-risk agri-food products actually compatible with the high-volume roll-on-roll-off trade that flows through Dover and the Channel Tunnel? If it isn't, what might be the alternatives? Will the new regime lead to delays and increased costs? Or could it be argued that having had more than 3 years to prepare, traders really ought to be ready to go this time around? Well, to weigh up the evidence and pass their own informed judgments, we have with us today a brace of experts who will guide us through the whys, wherefores, and why nots of the new system. It's a pleasure to welcome Anna Doherty, Senior Trade and Customs Specialist at the Institute of Export and International Trade. And it's great to also have with us William Bain, Head of Trade Policy at the British Chambers of Commerce. Thanks to both of you for joining us today. Anna, the UK left the EU single market on the 1st of January 2021. So why is it that we are only now getting around to imposing physical checks on imports from the EU?
I think what is really important to understand is that Border Target Operating Model imposes physical checks on sanitary and phytosanitary goods. We have had customs controls from the end of the transition period. We have had checks on goods arriving. We have had customs declarations required for sanitary and phytosanitary goods as well. So this is just another layer that needs to be imposed on those goods that require further checks due to the risk to human health and biosecurity.
William, what are the new rules that will apply as from the 30th of April, if everything goes according to schedule? And what will be the changes as compared with the current practice?
Well, I think the key differences that the business is preparing for and government is therefore getting ready to deliver on is that medium and high risk animal origin materials have to pass through a border control post when they enter Great Britain. So for most foodstuffs, this means really that entry will be via Dover and via Eurotunnel, which are the kind of two state-funded border control posts. And the other thing that comes in from the 30th of April, although the invoices don't start to drop until the end of July, so there is a bit of grace period for companies to prepare to at least make the payments, is the introduction of the common user charge, which is to pay for the two state border control post pieces of infrastructure and the checks processes that run through them. I mean, we should also say private ports operating their own border control posts, they are still going to set charges. It's widely believed that the charging regime which DEFRA and Treasury have set out for Eurotunnel and for Dover is kind of going to be the basis of the charges that people would face at privately run ports and privately operated border control posts.
So this is actually the second step in a kind of phased implementation process for these checks. There's been a requirement for EU imports of SPS goods, sanitary and phytosanitary products, to be accompanied by certifying documents since the 31st of January this year. How successful has this phase one been so far?
While the health certificates have been required from the 31st of January, the checks on these have been mainly done in the background. DEFRA has established what they call a central hub. So they've used this period between the 31st of January to the 30th of April to judge the readiness of the systems that they're trying to implement, both from the point of view of readiness of the importers and the exporters in the EU, because obviously this is a big change for them as well. Prior to the 31st of January, they didn't really need to raise export health certificates other than for those goods of the most highest risk. For majority of the products that are coming in under the medium risk category, you now need an export health certificate. They were being checked by DEFRA in the background. There have been definitely some lessons to be learned in terms of the guidances that have been published for completion of these documents. You have a wide network of users, of traders, that have previously perhaps not been aware of the requirements. This is brand new to them. If they've never imported SBS goods from any of the rest of the world countries, this has been a bit of a steep learning curve for them, but also a learning curve for DEFRA and for HMRC in making sure that the systems that are going to be needed to be in place to interact with each other from the 30th of April to make sure that any checks can happen at the border control posts are actually working correctly, are corresponding with each other, and that there is a capacity within those systems to handle an increased level of declarations and of checks.
And of course, this is perhaps the key question. William, how well prepared do you think the different players in the supply chain are, the importers, the exporters, the hauliers, the border officials? How well prepared are they for the changes that will come in at the end of April?
I think particularly the exporting companies in the EU have a sense of what they will be asked to do and to go through. The question is, though, whether the processes that are going to operate actually work. So we've been having quite a bit of discussion with the Dutch horticultural organizations, with the Dutch meat exporting organizations, and there are clearly going to be problems. If we continue with, for example, 24 hours pre-notification before the goods arrive, then that's really going to impact the shelf life of chilled chicken, for example, which we import a lot of into Great Britain, cut flowers that we have on our tables. So I think with the exporters, there is decent knowledge, but still scepticism about whether these processes can in effect reflect the reality of just-in-time supply chains that consumers still want to see. I think on the GB side, it is quite patchy, the sort of knowledge and understanding of and appreciation by SMEs about what's coming up. I mean, I went to my local Italian deli in Glasgow, 5 minutes walk away yesterday, and spoke with the store owner. And they had absolutely no idea that all of this new set of structures was coming in, no idea about the common user charge. Why would they? They're running a business focusing on all of that. So I think there is a concern that many SMEs in the UK are still in the dark about what's going to happen. And the real concern is that they only really twig to this when they get those first invoices in, either directly as the importer of record or from their customs providers at the end of July.
I would very much agree with William. And I think part of the problem also is because we had a staged implementation in that documents were needed from the 31st of January, if you're at the end of that supply chain, if you're not necessarily the importer at the border, you may not have known that anything has changed. It's the 30th of April that will introduce physical checks that could actually delay the goods at the UK border. Now, what you could have seen from the 31st of January in that phase where we needed to start getting export health certificates is that goods were taking a little bit longer to get out of the EU to actually come through to you. So if you're asking businesses in the UK, have you seen disruptions at the UK border? You probably wouldn't have seen any because there have not been any checks. But to be able to get an export health certificate from the EU member state, you need to have those goods certified. That takes time. There's an additional cost with that. So supply chains are having to adapt. And as William mentioned, the 24-hour pre-notification period, that is, for some supply chains, quite long. When you consider how close relationship that businesses in the UK have with the counterparts in the EU. You could place your order first thing in the morning, have it picked and packed in the afternoon and on the trailer by the evening. So it's quite difficult to actually ensure that you have all of the documentation in place within that period. Now, there is an element of derogation, especially for the animal products, that you can ask for a reduction in the window in which you have to pre-notify. But that is based on individual port health authorities at each border location and on a case-by-case basis. So just because you have had a derogation from the 12 hours to at a maximum 4 hours on one of your shipments, it doesn't mean that you will continue getting that derogation for each and every one of your shipments. And this lack of certainty means that it's very difficult to plan your supply chains, to plan your deliveries. What we may start seeing is that importers will start placing bigger orders, of course, but maybe less often. So what you may find is that the availability of the products or the range of it reduces to better plan the supply chains. Ultimately, these are products with short shelf life, so there's only so much you can do about it.
Now, we've already mentioned that inspection fees will be introduced, and there's been some controversy about the fact that these will apparently be charged per product rather than per lorry load. So if you're bringing in a large lorry with one commodity in it, you might be charged less than if you bring in a small lorry with lots of different products in it. How is that likely to affect the logistics of UK goods imports and perhaps the economics of importing food and perishable agri-food products into the UK?
It's really hard on SMEs. And of course, I think it's important to sort of emphasize, I mean, these policy responses originate from Brexit, but these are autonomous decisions which Treasury and DEFRA are taking. And where the burden of the common user charge falls upon is entirely a decision for the UK government. It's nothing to do with the EU at all. So to really have a sort of flat rate charge of £145 for just five different commodities, it really impacts negatively on regular, but nevertheless small consignment importers. So we're hearing stories that firms could be facing sort of five-figure sums per month in terms of charges. Now, firms can obviously try and mitigate their exposure to the common user charge by grouping as much as possible, given that there is that cap of five commodity lines, which is involved both for low-risk products like cheese or medium-risk products like meats and fish, egg and milk. But there's only so much mitigation you can do. And for smaller delis, for restaurants, for cafes, you can see that charges are going to mount up very quickly indeed. So we do think government should be looking at some of the proposals that made last year in the first consultation document, which was to really sort of emphasise that if you're in the trusted trader scheme, which underpins quite a lot of these processes, then you can perhaps have an exemption from the common user charge. We think government should revisit these ideas in order to mitigate the burden that we think very unfairly is going to fall disproportionately upon small and medium-sized importers.
I would agree in that it will be the small and medium businesses that will face the highest levels of charges. And to be fair, the impact onto them will be greater than on a supermarket basis or even a larger importer, because they'll be able to spread that cost across a lot of range of products. A lot of focus is given to the common user charge and how is that going to apply. Obviously, government has set that out at a different rate depending on the risk categorization of the product. But what it's really important to remember, and it's especially really important to remember for those small and medium enterprises when they calculate their exposure, is that as soon as they have a mixed consignment where they have both low and medium product on a single consignment, all of those low-risk products take on the charge of the highest-rated product within the consignment. So yes, if you have a consignment of only low-risk products, that is £10 per line, and that is £50 cap. But as soon as you introduce a single medium-risk product there, all of them are taking on £29 per consignment line, yes, capped to five. The common user charge as well is applicable in addition to the Port Health Authority charges that will be applied on documentary checks and on physical checks. So it's not just those caps that will be applicable in however many multiples. These are significant charges that businesses will need to face, and somebody ultimately is going to have to pay for it. As William mentioned, the common user charge will be applicable from the 30th of April, but will not actually be charged to businesses until at least 12 weeks later. And while this may offer a little bit of a breathing room in that an invoice will not be issued straight away, I think it also opens up a possibility of uncertainty of how these charges are actually going to be interpreted by DEFRA and indeed applied. When you have mixed consignments, as we said earlier, the awareness throughout the industry is mixed. So having an expectation that everybody that uses IPAFs will know what their charges will be, I think that is a very broad statement and a broad idea. And I think better visibility of what these charges will be from the 30th of April will be necessary, because some businesses may actually have a bit of a surprise when they receive that first invoice that backdates for up to 12 weeks. And if that doesn't match the calculations that they've done themselves, they may have completely misunderstood how those charges are being applied and therefore perhaps lost some money in the meantime.
And it's not just about Dover and the Channel Tunnel. There are private ports around England, Wales and Scotland, which have made hefty investments in infrastructure to allow them to implement this new system. Do they stand any chance of actually getting these costs back, or is this just a sort of a deadweight cost on their operation? Presumably, they won't be able to set their costs any higher than the Treasury set charges that we've just been speaking about.
Indeed, I think we'd expect that the suggested charges which Treasury has agreed with would be expected to be followed by the private sector as well. And of course, what we are hearing now already are that, of course, in some ports, there are relatively few movements of affected goods that will come through. Because, I mean, most of our food is coming really through Dover and Eurotunnel as the key ports of entry. And so the cost of maintaining infrastructure that may be sort of sitting idle for most of the day is being borne by these very few movements that are actually coming through on a daily basis. So there are going to be these issues about infrastructure standing idle but still being required and necessary, even for a very small number of SPS goods movements through the ports.
I think this is where the reaction to the common user charge will be different depending on who do you ask. If you ask a small and medium business, they will obviously be affected by perhaps a bit more than a larger trading business. If you ask BCP operators that operate privately, they will say, actually, you know, from our point of view, if we're looking to match our charges to the similar structure that the government is doing, that might not cover our operating costs. If the costs are disproportionately higher at other border control posts throughout the UK, what you may find is that in order to minimize cost exposure, trader and hauliers decide to route through Dover to make sure that they apply the lowest potential charges. That then means that there will be a high level of traffic coming through Dover, and there is a risk that the infrastructure will not be able to handle that level of traffic. So you might be seeing redirection there, unless those privately owned border control points match their pricing to the common user charge, which, as William said, may not be sufficient to actually maintain their operations.
So we're looking at increased costs, we're looking at bureaucratic hassles, we're looking at possible delays. How is the trade actually going to respond to these new developments? Some have suggested that European exporters might simply decide that they're not going to sell goods to the UK anymore because it's too much of a headache. Do you think that is at all likely, or are those claims overstated?
It was interesting that in the recent ONS trade data, okay, it's 1 month's trade figures covering the month of February, we did see a reduction in the amount of imported meats coming in from the Netherlands. And of course, that was just after the introduction of pre-notification and the requirement to have export health certificates with consignments. So 1 month's data, we'll be following it very closely, but some early signs that it is already having an effect on the willingness of European suppliers to send product across in the conditions which now apply to exports to Great Britain.
We're also seeing responses from, and this is especially applicable to those European businesses that may only perhaps operate within the single market and the UK, if they're not dealing with the rest of the world countries. To them, this is an additional burden, both in terms of costs in obtaining health certification, delays perhaps to orders. They may be seeing reduction in actually import orders from the UK, from the UK traders not wanting the hassle either. So absolutely, we are at risk that we could be seeing a less variety, especially from the smaller artisanal producers, where to them, the burden of trying to comply with all of these requirements will be significant. Additionally, we've spoken about the CUC charge, the charges for obtaining export health certificates and for inspections in the UK. The other thing that perhaps we might start to see is increase in costs for logistics, where the logistics operators are going to try to mitigate for the potential risk of delays at the border, making costs quite prohibitive and actually quite more expensive for those traders that may only be sending a small amount of goods on an infrequent basis.
How necessary is all of this? I mean, the UK's rules in areas like food safety, food security, have only diverged relatively little from those of the EU since the 3 years since we left the single market. So is it actually necessary to impose these kinds of checks?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, if you speak to government, they will say, of course, yes, there are requirements under WTO law. You've got to have adequate biosecurity regime to avoid pests and other unwanted things coming into the UK. However, it raises the wider question, is having two separate jurisdictions for SPS the best way to organise things? I mean, we're already, over the past 3 years, seen a huge amount of political capital, business capital being spent in relation to, firstly, the protocol, now renamed the Windsor Framework, all sorts of arrangements and workarounds in relation to that being put in place. I mean, look, ultimately, what is the answer to this as far as the BCC is concerned? We think there is a very powerful case for there being a veterinary agreement negotiated between the UK and the European Union, which would have the effect of removing this paperwork, removing the costs, making the cost of trade cheaper for business. And that should be a priority for whatever set of political discussions happens once the election cycles in the EU and the UK are completed. Because that deals with the issue at root. As you say, people want to see the same food standards as in the European Union. They don't feel that there's any benefit economically to trying to diverge from these standards. They're not comfortable with divergence in this area. So really, we should put the consumer case, the business case together and get a veterinary agreement that would, I think, make an enormous difference and really sort of be a bit of a game changer as far as our agri-food trade is concerned with our biggest market, the European Union.
We'll come back to that in just a moment. But Anna, how necessary do you think these checks are, the way things are currently in terms of the regulations in place?
One thing we have to remember is that even though the UK has left the European Union, the supply chains have not changed. We're still dealing with exactly the same goods as we have pre-EU exit. We're still dealing with the same risks. But we are now a third country to the European Union, and we are bound by the WTO SPS agreement. The trade and cooperation agreement between the UK and the EU does have a chapter on SPS, but we haven't got an SPS equivalent. So from biosecurity purposes, we are being treated as two separate entities. And while each side can unilaterally agree to lower procedural requirements, which is what we're seeing in the UK. We're seeing the introduction of the low, medium, and high risk categories. We're seeing a different levels of checks for that. We're seeing the removal of export health certificates. We're not seeing that in the EU. And the only way we would see the alignment in procedures is if we had an equivalent SPS agreement. Whether that is something that could be achieved or should be achieved, that is obviously a much bigger issue and question, as William has said. Ultimately, this is our closest trading partner, our supply chains remain intertwined. We do have goods that come in to us from the EU that then go back out to the EU that now have to be recertified. So looking at it should perhaps be the next stages of cooperation between the UK and the EU. And there is a committee as part of the TCA that looks at SPS measures and the alignment of these measures. But as I mentioned earlier, we are two separate entities when it comes to biosecurity. And so we will have our own concerns on both sides and measures as we have to implement them.
So let's look at that big issue. The Labour Party has said that if it wins the next election, it will try and negotiate a veterinary agreement between the UK and the EU. What could be the scope of such an agreement, practically speaking, given that association with the EU single market has been pretty decisively ruled out? And to what extent could any such agreement actually make this new border infrastructure and these new processes redundant?
So there are different kinds of relationship which a government that wants to try and reduce some of these costs to business could try and strike with the European Union. So New Zealand, for example, did an equivalence deal with the European Union. So that means that they have simplified but not eliminated and put into electronic form export health certificates and costs and paperwork between New Zealand and the EU. There are different variety of agreement, of course, were the kinds reached by Norway and Switzerland with the European Union, which, without oversimplifying it, pretty much involve a kind of dynamic alignment element in return for having an elimination of SPS paperwork and checks for goods crossing the border there. Now, the question is, what would an incoming government decide to go for? If you listen to Labour spokespeople, they will say they're not for dynamic alignment. So that would perhaps take it more to the New Zealand scale of things. But the EU says that it's not really interested in doing an equivalence arrangement with the UK, and it would prefer a more comprehensive agreement that did involve dynamic alignment. So there's a lot of issues that any negotiation would have to address. The EU would require a mandate to do this. There's the question about the process. You know, is this something that's going to be done in the context of the review of the operations of the TCA, or perhaps more likely through a separate political process after the election cycles, depending on the results? So a lot of issues, a lot of practical issues that would emerge from this. But business view is very clear that we would want to see a veterinary agreement that cuts costs, cuts red tape, and makes the cost of doing trade cheaper.
I think any alignment would be welcome by trade, absolutely. We still wouldn't be able to remove some of the barriers. And if you look at customs processes, you still have to have customs declarations. There's no way to move away from that while we are outside of the customs union. We're already accepting documents from the EU in an electronic form in terms of the export health certificates. So from the UK side, there's already quite a lot of simplifications being put forward. In terms of the future relationship, this will very much be dependent on the ambitions of, I think, both the EU and the UK on a much wider scale. Because if we are going towards an alignment of our SPS measures, that means we would have to treat third countries in a very similar way as well. We would have to have a joint approach to that. And so that obviously raises a question of then how free we are to negotiate trade agreements encompassing potentially SPS measures with third countries that are currently not having any trade agreements with the EU, and whether that would be a limiting thing for ourselves in the UK.
But of course, one area where a veterinary agreement might also help to reduce pressures and red tape is in the context of Northern Ireland, where we have all of these hoops to jump through at present with supply, with supermarkets in Great Britain, for example, sending goods for consumption within Northern Ireland. So do you think that might be a factor which might militate towards the conclusion of some kind of deal between a possible future UK government and the European Union?
It's interesting. I mean, if you look at, obviously, the supermarkets and the rollout of the not-for-EU labelling, I mean, it's proven to be unpopular with them and unpopular with other food retailers and indeed food manufacturers. So this is still a very contentious issue. The government's consulting on it at the moment, but it becomes a legal requirement from October for some foodstuffs, and again from next year for an even bigger category of foodstuffs. So an SPS agreement on the maximalist side of the scale, like Norway or like Switzerland, would mean that the requirement to have SPS processes between Great Britain and Northern Ireland would fall away, and therefore the requirement for the Not for EU label would fall away as well. So there is that sort of double bonus, as it were, that it makes trade between Great Britain and the EU a bit more friction-free, and it also significantly deals with the issues between GB and Northern Ireland as well. So I think there is the double bonus that could emerge from an SPS agreement that would reduce costs all round for businesses across the UK.
Northern Ireland's unique position will always influence overall UK policy in terms of trade, because we do have to consider the fact that we need to maintain a certain level of regulatory alignment with the EU for the purposes of Northern Ireland. And that means any significant diversion would be limited. So while alignment of SPS measures could remove some of that additional level of complexity when dealing for the great British businesses, when they're dealing with Northern Ireland, when they're sending goods to Northern Ireland, ultimately, it's a bigger question of policy around where do we want to go with a regulatory alignment with the EU and then the wider picture globally.
So as we move towards the end of our podcast, there's one question which I'd like to pose to both of you just to wrap up. You've both been rather critical of the new border operating model and the way it's currently being implemented. How sustainable do you think it is? How successful do you think it's likely to be? And what changes would you like to make if you had the ability to do so? Anna, can I come to you first? What is your view of the likely success of this scheme? And if it's not going to work, what should change?
I don't disagree with the border target operating model as a whole. It's bringing good principles, both around the SPS measures on the deal with the EU, and also it's simplifying trade with the rest of the world. It's aligning that. So it will make regulatory rules for imports of SPS goods from the rest of the world easy as well. It is bringing in principles of digitization, of making sure that we are more agile. It's bringing in single trade window as a concept that traders will be able to use. So I don't necessarily disagree with the border target operating model as a whole. What I think the issues are is the rate at which it is being implemented and the communication around how it is going to be implemented. With any new policy, there is always going to be hiccups. And initially, yes, there's going to be issues at the border as we ironed it out. But once this becomes a business as usual, once it has the time to embed, I think perhaps once businesses get time to get used to it, the disruption from it will be much less likely.
William, what's your view?
Well, we strongly endorse border digitalization and the first rollout of a single trade window at the end of October this year is welcome. We'd encourage in the next Parliament even more investment to go into digitalised borders. We think that can have wider economic benefits and benefits for global trade. The test will be, does the improved biosecurity measures come at a cost of affecting supply chains? Do we have delays, lack of choice, cost increases, which British consumers and ultimately policymakers conclude it's just not worth having two separate regulatory and checks regimes? And BCC is pretty convinced that there are clear benefits from moving to a system of more regulatory alignment in terms of goods with the European Union. Lower business costs would result from that. And I think that's going to be the calculation for policymakers. And fundamentally, we think that that economic imperative will guide policymakers in the EU and the UK towards reaching some sort of deal which recognises that UK standards and European standards are pretty much the same when it comes to food, and reach an agreement that cuts costs and the cost of doing trade for companies in both markets?
Well, time, as always, will tell. It's certainly going to be an interesting one to watch, particularly as the new border operating model is rolled out. But there we have to wrap up our podcast today. So I'd like to say a big thank you to my guests for their excellent contributions, to Anna Doherty and to William Bain. And a big thanks to all of you for listening, as always. So do join us again soon for another episode of Trade Bites. Trade Bites is brought to you by the Centre for Inclusive Trade Policy, supported by the Economic and Social Research Council.